Good evening, my name is John Olmschneider. I'm the university librarian here at Virginia Commonwealth University. And on behalf of Virginia Commonwealth University, the VCU libraries, I extend to all of you a very warm welcome, and we need it on this cold night, to the VCU Library's 15th annual Black History Month program. Each February for the past 14 years, the Friends of the Library and VCU Libraries have been proud to bring to you a fantastic array of speakers, events, and panelists to Virginia Commonwealth University. Now, tonight, we are delighted, deeply honored, and immensely proud to have Mr. Colson Whitehead with our 15th annual Black History Month lecturer. Mr. Whitehead is that rare breed of writer who is comfortable in many genres, including essays, novels, and book-length nonfiction. His essays and reviews have appeared in publications as diverse as The New Yorker, Harper's, The Village Voice, and The New York Magazine, among others. And in case you can't tell, he's a New York City native. His nonfiction and essays include two books, The Noble Hustle, Poker, Beef Jerky, and Death, and The Colossus of New York, and along with many essays and reviews. And he is also the author of six novels of immense diversity and scope. Among his many awards and recognitions are a MacArthur Fellowship, which many of us know as the Genius Grant, and a Guggenheim Fellow. And his works have been finalists for the Pulitzer Prize in Fiction, the Penn Faulkner Award for Fiction, and the Hurston Wright Legacy Award. His novels include his debut work, The Intuitionist, Apex Hides the Hurt, Sag Harbor, and his latest, The Underground Railroad, which was recognized with the prestigious National Book Award in November, and I must hasten to add, because I'm a librarian, the American Library Association's Carnegie Medal for Excellence in Fiction just last month at the conference of the American Library Association. And finally, I have to note that he's familiar with Richmond. He was here as a visiting writer at the University of Richmond in 2009, so he knows us a little bit, and I hope that he gets to learn more about us. We've changed a lot since 2009. It's easy to see why the Underground Railroad has received such acclaim. Certain characteristics distinguish the greatest works of literary fiction, and the Underground Railroad has them all. Mr. Whitehead shows a breathtaking mastery of his craft. He skillfully and invisibly blends allegory, alternative history, and historical fiction, magical realism, eternally memorable characters and personalities, and great tragedies into a captivating narrative to capture an immensely powerful story that I guarantee you will reward and enlighten you with every page. I'm not a literary critic. I don't have the vocabulary or the skills to convey to you the deep power of his latest work. But I do know that one of the most important tasks of all great fiction is to inspire and create empathy, to bring us to a richer and fuller and deeper understanding of the human condition and of all of us human beings who experience it. And Mr. Whitehead has truly achieved that goal in ways that places him, I think, now among the great of American novelists. Ladies and gentlemen, Colson Whitehead.
Howdy do. I usually spend Thursday nights at home in my apartment weeping over my regret. This is a nice change pace. So I'm going to start just talk briefly about my journey to this place, if you will, where I'm coming from, where I'm going. I hope you'll find parts of it entertaining. So I'll start at the beginning. I was born a poor black child. I remember the days sitting on the porch with my family, singing and a-dancing down in Mississippi. Or maybe that was someone else, Steve Martin and the Jerk. I was born and raised in Manhattan. I was a bit of a shut-in. I would have preferred to have been a sickly child, but it didn't work out that way. I always like it when you read a biography of someone like James Joyce and it says, they were a sickly child and forced to retreat into a world of imagination. It always sounds so wonderful. Instead, I just didn't like going outside. Other kids left their houses and did sports, played in the great outdoors. I like to stay inside watching The Twilight Zone and The Outer Limits. I really like comic books and science fiction, and I adored Stephen King. It seemed like in sixth grade reading comic books that writing X-Men or Spider-Man could be a great job. If you were a writer, you could work at home. You didn't have to wear clothes or talk to people. And you could just make up stuff all day. So until I got to college and started reading different kinds of fiction, I basically wanted to write The Black Shining or The Black Salem's Lot. If you take any Stephen King title and put The Black in front of it, That's basically what I wanted to do. And then, you know, freshman year, I started reading different kinds of fiction, modernists, etc. And I liked the equivalency I saw between science fiction and horror, which I read in junior high and high school, and, say, magic realism in Garcia Marquez, the absurd Beckett, the mythical landscapes of Borges, and seeing that they play with the fantastic as much as any genre writer. And then I think also it helps that for my first exposure to Beckett, found him to be a form of high realism. A guy is buried up to his neck in sand and can't move. He has an itch he can't scratch. That sounds like Monday morning to me. So in college, I consider myself a writer, but didn't actually sit down and write anything, which apparently is part of the process. I smoked cigarettes and I wore black, but didn't actually write. Finally, I mustered up the energy to write two stories, two five-page epics that I used to audition for the creative writing classes, and I was turned down each time. I was very devastated. It was good training for being a writer, because when you write stuff, everyone hates you and no one wants to read your stuff. And if you internalize that early, it'll serve you in good stead when you're a professional. So I was lucky when I got out of college to get a job at the Village Voice, which is an alternative newspaper in New York. The one thing you have to know about the Voice is that whenever you were there was when it was great, and then when you left, it went downhill. So if you're there in the 50s with Norman Mailer writing about beatnik culture, that's when the Voice was at its height. And then it went downhill when you left. And then if you were in the 70s writing about the birth of punk and disco, that's when the Voice was really hitting a new height. I was there from 91 to 96. We put out a great paper. It's a shame what happened to it since I moved on. But that's where I really started writing. I worked in the book section, and it was my job to open the 40 books a day we got from publishers. And that was my introduction to the capriciousness of the publishing industry, because we got 40 books a day in. We only reviewed 40 books a month. And then at the end of the month, my boss would call the Strand bookstore, and a guy would come with a shopping cart and review copies and give the money to my editor. And it turned out she was making like 10 grand a year off the books. And that's how it works. But the Village Voice was like a writer's paper, which meant that you could, if you hung around, you could get work. And so eventually, after 9 months, I hit up the TV critic for an assignment. He seemed like a good prospect and got my first assignment. It was a think piece about the season finales of the shows Growing Pains and Who's the Boss. Looking back, you know, 20-something years later, I think they really stand up as the definitive pieces about the season finales of those shows. And I was able to start writing TV criticism and book criticism, and eventually I felt confident enough to start working on my fiction. So I didn't want to do like a cliched autobiographical first novel where you get back at everyone who wronged you in childhood. I want to say that for my fourth novel, Sag Harbor. So I thought to psych out the publishing industry, I would write a book about a Gary Coleman-esque child star who has misadventures. And in the book, he's on a show. He's a kid, a black kid adopted by a rich white guy. And the sitcom in the book is called I'm Movin' In, with the apostrophe. Because in the 70s, if you remember, sitcoms were all about the apostrophe, like Different Strokes, What's Happening. And so this seemed like a real sop to realism. And I got an agent. I was very excited. And then we started sending the book out, and we started hearing back from people. So I, for one, was very surprised that a book about a Gary Coleman-esque child star would fail to find its place in the marketplace. The rejection slips began to accumulate, and I started to have really bizarre thoughts. So when I first became aware of Top 40 radio, it was the late 70s, so it meant a lot of disco, the Bee Gees, Diana Ross, Donna Summer. And for years, I tried to understand what the song MacArthur Park was about. I grew up on the Donna Summer version. Perhaps some of you are acquainted with the Richard Harris version with his Irish accent. And some of you don't even know what I'm talking about. So I brought an audio aid.
Yeah.
The song poses an enigma. Who left the cake out in the rain and why? Was it some childhood feud finally come to a head, a birthday of some sort, a celebration? It wasn't until I started getting all these rejection letters as I sat around my underwear watching Jerry Springer with the shades drawn that I finally understood what the song MacArthur Park is about. MacArthur Park is an investigation of the artist's journey. I'd gone to a lot of trouble gathering ingredients. And when I was done, someone left the cake out in the rain. All the sweet green icing was flowing down. I didn't think that I could take it because it took so long to bake it, frankly. And I would never, ever, ever have that recipe again. Knopf Publishing Group, why did you leave my cake out in the rain? Houghton Mifflin Publishing Group, why did you leave my cake out in the rain? Atlas Vanity Publishing of Secaucus, New Jersey, why did you not even return my phone calls? It was so weird. I thought about what else I might be able to do. My parents were of a generation that if you were an able-bodied black person, it was your duty to make something of yourself. Uplift the race, become a lawyer, a doctor, an accountant. Those professions weren't up my alley, so I tried to think about what else I might be able to do. And here I call your attention to my slender, delicate fingers and thin, feminine wrists. I bring them up not out of shame, but just to point out I'm not cut out for certain kinds of work. Far from shame, I guess mostly I feel a bit of sadness about my hands because we have just passed an important moment in our nation's history. When a skinny black man with slender figures and thin feminine wrists has actually become president. And now he's gone. So if it was ever our time, that was pretty much it. But back to my hands. These are hands that say pianist, hand model, surgeon. With these professions I might be suited for. Could I play the piano? Well, let me tell you a little story. The first thing I bought when I got a decent paycheck was an ergonomic chair. I slouch, I hunt and peck, and when I was writing my first book, I had to pop Advil all day because my neck was all fucked up from being hunched over. How could I sit at a piano bench without armrests, no lumbar support? I could not be a pianist. On paper, being a hand model must seem like the life. You get free watches, free hand cream, travel a lot, meet interesting people in the international jet set. But I had a very conservative upbringing. How could I indulge in the model lifestyle? I'd read stories about Kate Moss. This was the early 90s, so that was out. Finally, surgeon. I was all set to go down there. Just head on down there and sign up, whatever you do, med school. And then I heard about how long operations are. You have to stand on your feet for like 10, 15, 20 hours straight. What if you have to go to the bathroom? This kept running through my mind. Half the reason I got into the writing business was so that I could sit on my ass all day. So I tried to break it down scientifically. The average book of literary fiction sells 5,000 copies. 5,000 copies, if you're lucky. And now seeing that everyone reads it, loves the book, doesn't just throw it in the trash in disgust, and in addition makes 10 other people read it, then this book has 50,000 people. 50,000 people who like it. Well, there are 6.5 billion people in the world. You've made an impact in the lives of 0.00001% of the population. You're not even a gnat trying to catch the attention of an elephant. You're a microbe in the butt of a gnat trying to catch the attention of an elephant. And I know this is probably for young people who want to write in the audience. I just pulled the 5,000 number out of the air. I was trying to Google it before I got here, but I couldn't find the right search words. I'm supposed to go to the library, but at this point in my life, I want Google for everything, every aspect of my life. Like a Google superego. Say I'm out drinking and I think I'll have one more beer, the Google superego will go, do you mean go home right now? Or if it's Sunday afternoon and I'm like, oh look, there's a 15-hour Project One Way marathon on Bravo, I think I'll watch it, the Google superego will go, did you mean read a book and tell your family how much you love them? I think it would be a total killer app, personally. But where was I? The population of Earth. It's very intimidating. Well, what about life on other planets? You might naturally ask yourself next. Perhaps there is life on other planets, and they have a taste for language poetry, creative nonfiction, coming-of-age stories. Well, I hate to burst your bubble, but scientists say that the nearest planet outside our solar system is 10.5 light years away, which is pretty far. And the chance of one of our Earth scientists coming up with a faster-than-light drive in our lifetime is quite slim. Estimates about the possibility of life on other planets vary. Some say that only 1 in 100 million planets is capable of supporting life. And what's the chance they would like your crap anyway? They could have a complete haiku-based civilization up there. So you're out of luck. And I got very depressed thinking about it. And then one day I thought, maybe it's out of my hands. Maybe I have no choice. A friend of mine is a real jerk. He has some fine qualities, but there's no escaping that he's a real jerk sometimes. And for years I'd wonder how he came to be such a jerk. And it occurred to me, evolution. For generations, jerks have been breeding with other jerks to produce more jerks, who in turn breed with other jerks who have litters of jerks in turn. It must have happened thousands of years ago when some Neanderthal jerk got together with another Neanderthal jerk in a cave. Perhaps they met while fighting over a piece of saber-toothed meat and just clicked, started talking about the weather. Oh, Gluck Gluck, the thunder god, is quite angry today, don't you think? Yes, he is, and you have lovely eyes. And it was pure chemistry, and they took it from there. And they had a kid, and their jerk kid got together with another Neanderthal jerk kid, or Neanderthal of similar type, a moron or a douche. And they had a kid who was half jerk, half douche, and so on for millennia, more or less breeding and concentrating all those unpleasant qualities, herding all that negative DNA together until my friend was born. So I figure the same with writers. The artistic temperament must go back just as far. There's a Neanderthal who paused while beating in the skull of a Neanderthal from the next cave over, and he thought to himself, hunting and gathering, gathering and hunting. Is that all there is to this miserable life? And he became the first Neanderthal existentialist. And he found a Neanderthal of melancholy temperament, a Neanderthal female who just liked to draw non-representational doodles on the cave wall. And she was the first abstract artist. And then they had a kid who didn't like to hunt or gather, but just tell stories all day. And he found a suitable mate and so on throughout the centuries, spawning moody, arty kids. In the 1600s, one villager says to another, hey, did you see that new puppet show last night? And the artistic villager says, no, I don't watch puppet shows. I don't even own a puppet show set. I only listen to NPR. And so on to the present day. That artistic DNA surviving, getting together. So as I sat in my dirty apartment, watching Jerry Springer, relating all too deeply to Jerry Springer, I realized that I was the recipient of all that sit on your ass, muse about crap all day DNA. And it didn't matter that no one liked what I was doing. I had no choice. So I got back to work, and it went better the next time. So which brings us to the Underground Railroad. So I first had the idea like 16 years ago. I was sitting on my couch, came across a reference to the railroad. I remembered how when I was in fourth grade and first heard about it, I envisioned a literal subway beneath the earth, which is very impractical. And then my teacher explained how it actually worked. But it seemed all those years ago, wouldn't that be a weird idea for a book if the Underground Railroad was a literal thing? And then I quickly added that sort of element of each state that our protagonist goes through as she moves north is a different state of American possibility, sort of like Gulliver's Travel. And it seemed like a good idea. But I knew if I did it back then, I would have screwed it up. So I figured I'll just wait until I'm ready. And each time I finished a book, pull out my notes and think, am I ready? And each time the answer was like, no, you're still going to screw it up. And so that went on for many years until about 3 years ago. I had sold a book to my editor. But I was feeling sort of iffy about it. And so I told my wife about the Underground Railroad idea. Sometimes in a marriage, you have to make conversation to kill the silences. And so I shared this idea I'd had for a long time. And she said, well, honey, I don't want to say that your book about a Brooklyn writer going through a midlife crisis is dumb per se, but this other book idea you have sounds pretty good. So I was like, huh. I decided to tell my agent, who I've been with for 18 years, is always very supportive. And she said, Colson, well, both ideas sound good, which is not very helpful. But then she emailed me 2 days later and says, I can't stop thinking about that Underground Railroad thing. So I was like, huh. So Wednesday was a shrink day, so I went to my shrink, and she just said, what, are you crazy? Well, we both know you're crazy, but it sounds like this book would be really good for you right now. So I was like, huh. So I just left my editor, who I'd already sold this other idea to. And so I told the idea, and he just said, giddy up, motherfucker, which is publishing lingo for, I think that's a very good idea, and we should pursue it. So I did. And then the tone of the talk changed, people thought to themselves later. Our main character is Cora. She's 17 or 16. She doesn't really know her real age because slave masters didn't keep track of that sort of thing in the same way you wouldn't keep track of how old your hammer is or a plow. Why would you keep track of a slave? They're an object. She's alone on the plantation. It's owned by James and Terrence Randall, two brothers. There's a reference to Caesar, who has just come to the plantation. He was raised in Virginia and was a slave with his parents, working for a woman who promised that when she died, they would be set free. She did not follow through on that promise, and he was sold down south when she died. And each, you know, the further south you go, the worse it gets, plantation life. And he's now found himself on the Randall Plantation in a very different situation. This section is old Jockey's birthday. He's the oldest slave in the plantation. And whenever he feels like there's a need for release, he declares, it's my birthday, and it could be once or twice a year. And they have food and music, and it's a brief release from the terrible system. And the final person you need to know about is Chester, who's an orphan. He's 10 years old. And Cora, our protagonist, has taken him under her wing. The music stopped. The circle broke. Sometimes a slave will be lost in a brief eddy of liberation, in the sway of a sudden reverie among the furrows or while untangling the mysteries of an early morning dream, in the middle of a song on a warm Sunday night. Then it comes always, the overseer's cry, the call to work, the shadow of the master, the reminder that she's only a human being for a tiny moment across the eternity of her servitude. The Randall brothers had emerged from the great house and were among them. The slaves stepped aside, making calculations of what distance represented the right proportion of fear and respect. Godfrey, James's houseboy, held up a lantern. According to old Jockey, James favored the mother, stout as a barrel and just as firm in countenance, and Terrence took after the father, tall and owl-faced, perpetually on the verge of swooping down on prey. In addition to the land, they inherited their father's tailor, who arrived once a month in his rickety carriage with his samples of linen and cotton. The brothers dressed alike when they were children and continued to do so into manhood. Their white trousers and shirts were as clean as the laundry girl's hands could make them, and the orange glow of the lantern made the men look like ghosts emerging from the dark. Master James, Jockey said. His good hand gripped the arm of his chair as if to rise. Master Terrence. Don't let us disturb you, Terrence said. My brother and I were discussing business and heard the music. I told him, now that is the most god-awful racket I've ever heard. The Randalls were drinking wine out of goblets of cut glass and looked as if they'd drained a few bottles. Cora searched for Caesar's face in the crowd. She didn't find him. He hadn't been present the last time the brothers appeared together on the northern half of the plantation. You did well to remember the different lessons of those occasions. Something always happened when the Randalls ventured into the quarter together. Sooner or later, a new thing coming you couldn't predict until it was upon you. James left the daily operations to his man Connolly and rarely visited. He might grant a tour to a visitor, a distinguished neighbor or curious planter from another neck of the woods, but it was rare. James rarely addressed his niggers, who'd been taught by the lash to keep working and ignore his presence. When Terrence appeared in his brother's plantation, he usually appraised each slave and made a note of which men were the most able and most women the most appealing. Content to leer at his brother's women, he grazed heartily upon the women of his own half. I like to taste my plums, Terrence said, prowling the rows of cabins to see what struck his fancy. He violated the bonds of affection, sometimes visiting slaves on their wedding night to show the husband the proper way to discharge his marital duty. He tasted his plums and broke the skin and left his mark. It was accepted that James was of a different orientation. To hear his valet prideful tell it, James confined his erotic energies to specialized rooms in a New Orleans establishment. The madam was broad-minded and modern, adept in the trajectories of human desire. Prideful stories were hard to believe, despite assurances that he received his reports from the staff of the place, with whom he'd grown close over the years. After all, what kind of white man would willingly submit to the whip? Terence scratched his cane in the dirt. It had been his father's cane, topped with a silver wolf's head. Many remembered its bite on their flesh. Terence said, "Then I recollected James tell me about a nigger he had down here, could recite the Declaration of Independence. I can't bring myself to believe him. I thought perhaps tonight he can show me, since everyone is out and about, from the sound of it." James said, "We'll settle it. Where is that boy, Michael?" No one said anything. Godfrey waved the lantern around pathetically. Moses was the boss, unfortunate enough to stand closest to the Randall brothers. He cleared his throat. "Michael dead, Master James." Michael, the slave in question, had indeed possessed the ability to recite long passages. According to Connolly, who heard the story from the nigger trader, Michael's former master was fascinated by the abilities of South American parrots and reasoned that if a bird could be taught limericks, a slave might be taught to remember as well. Merely glancing at the size of their skulls told you that a nigger possessed a bigger brain than a bird. Michael had been the son of his master's coachman, had a brand of animal cleverness, the kind you see in pigs sometimes. The master and his unlikely pupil started with simple rhymes and short passages from popular British versifiers. They went slow over the words the nigger didn't understand, and if truth be told, the master only half understood. But they made miracles, the tobacco farmer and the coachman's son. The Declaration of Independence was their masterpiece. Michael's ability never amounted to more than a parlor trick, delighting visitors before the discussion turned, as it always did, to the diminished faculties of niggers. His owner grew bored and sold the boy south. By the time Michael got to Randall, some torture or punishment had addled his senses. He was a mediocre worker. He complained of noises and black spells that blotted his memory. In exasperation, Connolly beat out what little brains he had left. It was a scourging that Michael was not intended to survive, and it achieved its purpose. James said, "I should have been told," his displeasure plain. Michael's recitation had been a novel diversion the two times he trotted the nigger out for guests. Terence liked to tease his brother. "James," he said, "you need to keep better track of your property. Don't meddle." "I knew you let your slaves have revels," Terence continued, "but I had no idea they were so extravagant. Are you trying to make me look bad?" "Don't pretend you care what a nigger thinks about you, Terence." James's glass was empty. He turned to go. Terence tapped his cane. His face sank as he took in the crowd. "Oh, one more song, James. These sounds have grown on me." George and Wesley, the musicians, were forlorn. Noble and his tambourine were nowhere to be seen. James pressed his lips into a slit. He gestured, and the men started playing. James said, "You're not going to dance? I have to insist. You and you and you." They didn't wait for their master's signal. The slaves of the northern half converged on the alley, haltingly, trying to insinuate themselves into their previous rhythm and put on a show. Putting on a show for master was a familiar skill, the small angles and advantages of the mask, and they shook off their fears as they settled into the performance. Oh, how they capered and hollered, shouted and hopped. Certainly this was the most lively song they'd ever heard, the musicians, the most accomplished players the colored race had to offer. Cora dragged herself into the circle, checking the Randall brothers' reactions on every turn, like everyone else. Jockey tumbled his hands in his lap to keep time. Cora found Caesar's face. He stood in the shadow of the kitchen, his expression flat. Then he withdrew. "You!" It was Terence. He held his hand before him as if it were covered in some eternal stain that only he could see. Then Cora caught sight of it, the single drop of red wine staining the cuff of his lovely white shirt. Chester, the boy, had bumped him. Chester simpered and bowed before the white man. "Sorry, master, sorry, master." The cane crashed across his shoulder and head again and again. The boy screamed and shrank to the dirt as the blows continued. Terence's arm rose and fell. James looked tired. One drop. A feeling settled over Cora. She'd not been under its spell in years, since she'd brought the hatchet down on Blake's doghouse and sent the splinters into the air. She'd seen men hung from trees and left for buzzards and crows, women carved open to the bones with a cat of nine tails, feet cut off to prevent escape and hands cut off to stop theft. She'd seen boys and girls younger than this beaten and had done nothing. But this night, the feeling settled over her heart again. It grabbed hold of her, and before the slave part of her caught up with the human part of her, she was bent over the boy's body as a shield. She held the cane in her hand like a swamp man handling a snake and saw the ornament at its tip. The silver wolf bared its silver teeth. Then the cane was out of her hand. It came down on her head. It crashed down again, and this time the silver teeth ripped across her eyes and her blood splattered the dirt. So that's it for that night. After that, things become untenable for Cora on the plantation, and she decides to run with Caesar on the Underground Railroad. And there's the main storyline of Cora as she goes to these different states and these different alternative Americas. And then there are five or six, I call them biographical section, focusing on different supporting players. And they're usually about six pages, but Arnold Ridgway, the slave catcher, demanded 10 pages, so I gave him 10 pages, even though it broke my system and I felt really weird for like a long time. So this is Arnold Ridgway, the slave catcher who pursues Cora when she runs away. Arnold Ridgway's father was a blacksmith. The sunset glow of molten iron bewitched him, the way the color emerged in the stock, slow and then fast, overtaking it like an emotion. The sudden pliability and restless writhing of the thing as it waited for purpose. His forge was a window into the primitive energies of the world. Ridgway's father had a saloon partner named Tom Bird, a half-breed who took a sentimental turn when lubricated by whiskey. On nights when Tom Bird felt separate from his life's design, he shared stories of the Great Spirit. The Great Spirit lived in all things, the earth, the sky, the animals, the forests, flowing through and connecting them in a divine thread. Although Ridgway's father scorned religious talk, Tom Bird's testimony on the Great Spirit reminded him of how he felt about iron. He bent to no god save the glowing iron he tended in his forge. He'd read about the great volcanoes, the lost city of Pompeii, destroyed by fire that poured out of the mountains from deep below. Liquid fire was the very blood of the earth. It was his mission to upset, mash, and draw out the metal into the useful things that made society operate. Nails, horseshoes, plows, knives, guns, chains. Working the spirit, he called it. When permitted, young Ridgway stood in a corner while his father worked Pennsylvania iron, melting, hammering, dancing around his anvil, sweat dripping down his face, covered in soot, foot to crown, blacker than an African devil. "You gotta work that spirit, boy," he'd say. One day he would find his spirit, his father told him. He was 14 when he took up with the patrollers. Slave patrol was not difficult work. They stopped any niggers they saw and demanded their passes. They stopped niggers they knew to be free for their amusement, but also to remind the Africans of the forces arrayed against them, whether they were owned by a white man or not. Sort of like Donald Trump asking for Obama's birth certificate. You always have to show your papers, then and now. They made the rounds of the slave villages in search of anything amiss, a smile or a book. They flogged the wayward niggers before bringing them to jail, or directly to their owner if they were in a mood and if it was not too close to quitting time. News of a runaway sent them into cheerful activity. They raided the plantations after their quarry, interrogating a host of quivering darkies. Free men knew it was coming and hid their valuables and moaned when the white men smashed their furniture and glass, praying that they can find their damage to objects. There were perquisites. Apart from the thrill of shaming a man in front of his family or roughing up an unseasoned buck who squinted at you the wrong way, the old Mutter farm had the comeliest colored wenches Mr. Mutter had a taste. And the excitement of the hunt sent the young patroller into a lusty mood. According to some, the backwoods stills of the old man on the stone plantation produced the best corn whiskey in the county, and a roust allowed Chandler around Ridgway to replenish his jars. Ridgway commanded his appetites in those days, withdrawing before his Confederates' more egregious displays. The other patrollers were boys and men of bad character. The work attracted a type. In another country, they would have been criminals, but this was America. He liked the night work at best, when they lay in wait for a buck who sneaked through the woods to visit his wife in a plantation up the road, or a squirrel hunter looking to supplement his daily meal of slop. Other patrollers carried guns to eagerly cut down any rascal dumb enough to flee, but not Ridgway. Nature had equipped him with weapons enough. Ridgway ran them down as if they were rabbits, and then his fists subdued them. Beat them for being out, beat them for running, even though the chase was the only remedy for his restlessness. Charging through the dark, branches lashing his face, stumps sending him ass over elbow before he got up again. In the chase, his blood sang and glowed. So he's a slave patroller, and then he progresses to slave catcher. New York was the start of a wild time. Ridgway worked retrieval, heading north when constables sent word they'd captured a runaway from Virginia or North Carolina. New York became a frequent destination. And after exploring different aspects of his character, Ridgway picked up stakes. The fugitive trade back home was straightforward, knocking heads. Up north, the gargantuan metropolis, the liberty movement, and the ingenuity of the colored community all converged to portray the true scale of the hunt. He was a quick study. It was more like remembering than learning. Sympathizers and mercenary captains smuggled fugitives into city ports, and in turn, stevedores and dockhands and clerks furnished him with information, and he scooped up the rascals on the threshold of deliverance. Freemen informed their African brothers and sisters, comparing the descriptions of runaways in the gazettes with the furtive creatures slinking around the colored churches, saloons, and meeting houses. Soon he owned three fine coats. He fell in with a circle of slave catchers, gorillas stuffed into black suits with ridiculous derbies. He had to prove he was not a bumpkin, but just once. Together they shadowed the runaways for days, hiding outside places of work until opportunity announced itself, breaking into their Negro hovels at night to kidnap them. After years away from the plantation, after taking a wife and starting a family, they had convinced themselves that they were free, as if owners forgot about property. Their delusions made them easy prey. He snubbed the Blackbirders, the Five Points gang who hogtied freemen and dragged them south for auction. That was low behavior, patroller behavior. He was a slave catcher now. While Ridgway waited at the docks for smugglers, the magnificent ships from Europe dropped anchor and discharged their passengers, everything they owned in sacks, half-starving, hapless as niggers by any measure. But they'd be called to their proper places, as he had been. His whole world growing up in the South was a ripple of this first immigrant arrival, this dirty white flood with nowhere to go but out, south, west. The same laws governed garbage and people. The gutters of the city overflowed with refuse, but the mess found its place in time. Ridgway watched them stagger down the gangplanks, roomy and bewildered, overcome by the city. The possibilities lay before these pilgrims like a banquet, and they'd been so hungry their whole lives. They'd never seen the likes of this, but they'd leave their mark on this new plan as surely as those famous souls at Jamestown, making it theirs through unstoppable racial logic. If Negroes were supposed to have their freedom, they wouldn't be in chains. If the red man was supposed to keep hold of his land, it'd still be his. If the white man wasn't destined to take this new world, he wouldn't own it now. Here was the true great spirit, the divine thread connecting all human endeavor. If you can keep it, it's yours. Your property, slave, or continent. The American imperative. Ridgway gathered renown with his facility for ensuring that property remained property. When a runaway took off down an alley, he knew where the man was headed, the direction and aim. his trick. Don't speculate where the slave is headed next. Concentrate instead on the idea that he's running away from you. Not from a cruel master or the vast agency of bondage, but you specifically. It worked again and again, his own iron fact, in alleys and pine barrens and swamps. He finally left his father behind and the burdens of that man's philosophy. Ridgway was not working the spirit. He was not the smith rendering order, not the hammer, not the anvil. He was the heat. Thank you. But I guess now that the Q&A portion of our program can commence, so if you have any questions or tips.
Thank you for that reading. So my question was, coming from such an incredible history of remarkable literary works written by Black authors that revisit slave narratives from Beloved or Kindred or Corregidora, when you sat down to write this work, was there any anxiety or hesitancy or intimidation, and within the space that you could reinvent the wheel or include your own imagination or voice in this greater discourse on race and history and even gender?
Well, you know, with some books, I do want to see what other people have done, and then some books I don't. It sort of depends where I am pre-anxiety-wise. With this, I just want to see how other, revisit how other people had treated it. So I was like, I'm going to read Beloved again. I hadn't read in 30 years. I'm going to read The Known World, Edward Jones, Middle Passage by Charles Johnson. And so I pulled down Beloved, my college copy of Beloved, and got 30 pages in. And I was just like, oh, I'm totally fucked. Because Toni Morrison's an incredible genius, and you can't really compete with that. So I stopped reading the novelist. And really, no matter what you're writing, you have this hope that you have something new to contribute to the subject. No matter what you're writing about, whether it's slavery or war, domestic troubles, someone smarter and more talented has done it before you got to the scene. So all you can hope is that with your whatever particular set of skills and experiences and talent, you can do your own thing. And so that was settled. I'll just do my own thing and not worry about Toni Morrison. My real pre-anxiety, when I started doing the research as a grown-up, as opposed to reading about slavery in college or whatever, was having a realistic section before I started playing with reality. So I do change historical events as the book progresses, but recognizing that my family went through this, I don't know who they were or where they lived and died, you know, my family history, except for one strand, which actually does, it's like 200 years in Virginia. I don't know whether most of my family lived and died in Alabama, Florida, what they worked on, how they lived and suffered. Apparently some of them made it out because I'm here. But before I started playing with reality, I wanted to get it right. And so trying to get it testify for them and as much as I could, and other people who went through slavery as much as I can, and have a realistic Georgia plantation, hence that first section I read of Jockey's Party, before I started playing with things. So the anxiety of influence I set aside, and then the anxiety of just trying to somehow represent the true brutality and reality of what my family went through was the sort of more anxiety-provoking part. Thanks.
Are you able to put your anger aside, and if so, how?
Am I able to put my anger aside? If so, how? Well, no, the first Star Wars reboots were disappointing after how much it meant to me as a young person. In terms of this book, realizing what I was going to put on the page, and it wasn't even anger, it was more sadness. What I had to put Cora and supporting cast through, was very depressing. And then I started writing, and that's what sort of cured me. I wrote the first six-page Ajari section, which is Cora's grandmother, and that gave me a sort of narrative voice that allowed me to sort of be close with the characters, but also distance and sort of pull back. And that seemed a good way to deal with the subject. And then my office is we have a duplex, and my office is in the basement, so I can just work till 3. Then I'm like, what am I going to make for dinner for my family? And it's like totally separate. I come up, and it's like a different space. So I'm not like carrying it with me when I knock off from work. I had that distance when I was writing the book, and then I got to page 100, and it wasn't really affecting me, but I was like, oh, I'll watch 12 Years a Slave now. I've been putting it off. some research. Maybe I'll get some kind of noun or slang word from it. And I couldn't finish it. Even though I was putting on the page every day, seeing human actors, even just actors, go through it was really too painful. And so I had to stop the movie, and I still haven't finished it. I had some sort of compartmentalization going on where I could shape all the terrible research and not be angry and depressed and hopefully make it into an artistic creation. But obviously, it would be a long time before I see, like, the rest of the movie or, like, the Roots reboot. You know, I taped it, but I was like, but I'm still too... I don't want to see people actually doing the stuff that I was putting on the page.
How long it took you to write it? You have a great sense of humor, which must have kept you from going crazy, because it's a book that has to be read twice. It is so brutal that you can't read the allegory or the what's underneath without doing it twice. And so the question is, how could you stand it? How much of a given day could you stand it? And how long?
No, yeah, it sort of overlaps with that question. In terms of how long it took, well, I had it in the back of my head for many years, you know, white supremacist state, question mark, and I would, you know, every couple of years in between books, I would add a little bit of notes. And then when I actually sat down to write, it was like a year of research and writing. You know, I teach a lot, and I finished the semester and just sort of let it rip, and it came out really quickly. I guess when I'm working, I don't do anything else. I don't, like, hopefully I'm not doing a day job. I don't multitask on work. So I'm just trying to do like 8 pages a week. That's sort of like a good rate for me. If I can do 8 pages, like 4 on Monday and then 2 on Friday and then 2 Sunday, that counts. Sometimes it's 4 on Saturday and 4 on Sunday if I slack off all week. But for me, writing a novel is sort of like, you know, it's a marathon, etc. So, but if I keep that steady accumulation, I'm not thinking about anything else except food, be nice to the kids. So, but I guess a year. What it took.
Can you talk a little bit about Homer and where that character came from? He's quite tragic and hard character. It adds his layer of complexity also to Ridgway. So can you just talk a little bit about him?
Sure. Homer, Ridgway, the slave catcher's sidekick. The thing about waiting is that the book came out differently. So if I wrote it 10 years ago or 5 years ago, it would have been very different. And I think with Homer, a younger version of me would have really over-explained Homer's psychology. But my theory with Homer was just like, Homer's going to Homer and do what Homer wants, and that's okay. So he's a 10-year-old boy or 12-year-old boy who's been freed by Ridgway, but he stays with Ridgway as his assistant, and he writes down Ridgway's, you know, pensées and philosophical thoughts. The good thing about the structure of the book, where it's sort of rebooting every 60 pages, is that I get to have a big cast. And so we get one example of the master-slave relationship with Terence, the sadistic brother, and say Cora. And then we have another example with Ridgway and Homer. You know, there were slaves who, once they were freed, 64, 65, first heard they were free, stayed on a plantation because they'd never known anything else. And they'd been brutalized, but there was really no world that they knew of the plantation, so they stayed to work for their former master, which seems weird to me. And then there are masters who would beat, torture, rape, severely punish their slaves. But when they died, would, you know, swear that, oh, old Bessie raised me, you know, in that Gone with the Wind sense, where, like, even though they were an object, my property, an object, they're like part of the family. And so what corner of that weird master-slave relationship can I address? And so Homer and Ridgway hopefully have a little bit of exploring that in a different way, the dynamic that we're sort of talking about. You can choose whoever, you have the microphone.
Thank you. My question is similar to hers. I just want to know a little bit about Cora. Did you always know she would take your reader through this journey, or did you have another character in mind to play protagonist initially, or did you always know that she was going to be the one to go through the journey?
Yeah, I mean, I over the years, like in the back of my head, the main character was going to be a man running away by himself, a young man, a man looking for his wife who'd been sold off. At the point, it was a parent looking for a child. And then I hit upon Cora. For many reasons. I hadn't had a female protagonist in a while, so it's like, change it up, Coulson. One of the first slave narratives I read 30 years ago in college was by Harriet Jacobs, a very famous slave narrative. She writes very movingly about how when she hits puberty, she hits the most terrible time in a slave girl's life. Now you're supposed to pump out kids, because more kids means more hands, pick more cotton means more money. It's a very different female slave situation. It's complex in a different way than the male slave's plantation experience. and that seemed worthy of doing. I hadn't had a mother-daughter relationship on the page before, so that seemed worthy of doing. And then I didn't know who she was. I knew what she was going to do. And then I started writing, and the two moments that made her clear for me, because how do you get into the psychology of someone who's brave enough to run away? Most of us wouldn't do it, but how do you make that leap of imagination and bravery to say, I can be killed if I'm caught, but I'm going to do it? And so the first one is when she stands up to the bully who steals her garden, and then the second is when she protects Chester. And of all the slaves, and we all would have been in the same place. We would have seen the kind of brutality every day, and we don't step in because we get beaten also. So what kind of person does that? It's, you know, insane. So I knew who she was when she did those two things, and I figured out those two things for her. So.
Although you alluded to this during your talk, I wondered if you could tell us a little bit more about your family, where you came from. I'm interested in the nonfiction story, and I wonder, are you connected with the Colsons from Virginia, some of whom I've known?
Sure. My own family history, where I come from, and my connection to the Colsons of Virginia, some of whom you know. The book came out, I was like, I actually don't know much about my family history. And then a genealogist in my family was like, no, we know that there is one of us who was biracial and was sold as an indentured servant to James Madison. And I was like, really? You know, like, hear about people with their past lives. They're always like, oh, it's Cleopatra. Like, are you sure it was James Madison and not like James P. Madison? Yeah. And then they became free black folks in Virginia and had a tavern that that they ran for many generations in Culpeper, so that's one. And my grandmother was from that line. She married a guy named Colson Woody from Virginia, but I'm not sure if that's one of the Colsons that you know. And then my grandmother is from Barbados, which was a sugar crop. And they really sort of figured out how to do mass production slave work and what they did to the slaves in order to make them to make rum and processed sugar was imported to the cotton states. The brutality to keep people in line. So then my dad's family, his father, came from Florida, half Seminole, half black. So that's all I know personally. I guess that was the question, right?
Yeah.
No, that's a good question. The question is about avoiding doing the work on this book because it's very daunting and terrifying. Did I feel like my ancestors talking to me and was I communicating back? I think I put it off when I was 30 because I didn't want to do the research because it was terrifying. I didn't feel I was able to pull it off technically, and definitely the book would have been different and not as good if I'd done it 16 years ago. In terms of my ancestors talking to me, I really thought I was more talking to them. You know, I mean, I saw Roots, and that was my first introduction to slavery. I was 8. And then I, in college, studied American history. But coming to the material as a semi-grown-up with kids and imagining seeing my mother getting beaten or sold off or abused, my kids seeing me happen to me, their mother, go through it. I think just as you get older, you have a new appreciation of just how terrible it is as you have more stakes in your life and a more appreciation of what it actually meant. So I talked about getting it right in that first state chapter. So I was talking to them like, there's no way you could imagine my life, semi-depressed, semi-happy novelist, but making a career. You know, you can imagine a black president from where you're from. You know, that's, the world has changed so much. And there's no way that I can even imagine what you went through. And I try to get on the page, and it's like a 1,000,000% of what they actually experienced. And so I'm like, oh, I have to deal with this research, and it's terrifying, and I am putting brutality on the page. And then people who read the book are like, it was really hard going. Well, you know, actually being there was harder. So I felt the communication was me. I'm just trying to talk to you, nameless ancestors. I don't even know where you lived and died, and hopefully get it right for you.
What was the actual time frame of this? That's the first part. Was it the 1820s, 30s, 40s? And all you happened to get drawn, I noticed in your acknowledgments, you did a whole lot of research at UNC at Greensboro, the archive. So how did you end up there, and how much of your research did you draw upon at that university?
Sure. It's not named in the book, but my mental date was 1850 with the Fugitive Slave Act which means that people like Ridgway can go to the north and snatch people who've been free for a long time. So that's the benchmark of technology and slang. But then as you get into the other states, I'm moving history around, and so there's no real date. But for me, mentally, 1850 was the cutoff for technology and slang. We're not so close to the Civil War, but we're in a year or two into the Fugitive Slave Act. In terms of research, I don't like leaving the house, and so I do a lot of work online, and a lot of the slave narratives I was rereading, or the oral testimonies captured by the WPA in the 1930s, they're all digitized by the Library of Congress. We own them, and so I could just download them. When I first started doing interviews, there were people who were like, we could do a shoot in your house, and then can we see some of the artifacts from your research, like a slave shackle? And I was like, I have this. I downloaded stuff on my iPad. It's all in here. It's not very sexy. And then in the book, there are four or five interspersed runaway slave ads, and they're from the digital archive at the University of North Carolina. I did not actually go there. And, you know, for a fiction writer, just going through runaway slave ads is like your slave runs away. You place an ad in a newspaper. Reward, $50. Bessie, age 10, mulatta, ran away from our plantation for no good reason. We know why. And the University of North Carolina has digitized all these newspaper classified ads, which is really great. And for as a fiction writer, I just collect names like Bessie, Cora, and I get, you know, slang and stuff like that. So I thank them in there because they helped me a lot in the book. Two things. There are biographical sections like Ridgway, and I knew like the main characters of each state, white supremacist state, black utopia. As I was writing the book before I started, characters were auditioning for the biographical slot. So after the North Carolina section, should Martin or his wife get it? Martin or Ethel, and then who's more Ethel? And then should you put the Caesar one or the Martin one or the Cora's mother one at the beginning of the book? On page 70 or page 185 or page 270. And so, while I had the structure before I started, those short chapters were always sort of moving around for different effect. And in terms of Mabel, I hadn't decided to put her in or not until I was about two-thirds of the way through. And then I started, should I appear after the Georgia section, North Carolina section, or Indiana? So, while I am sort of anal about structure, you do have to allow for the creative process. And so the big structural element that moved was for those chapters. In terms of railroad, I didn't envision it until I started writing. And for me, and like if I'd written it 5 years ago, I would have spent a lot more time underground. I would have been like, who made the trains and who dug them and all this stuff. For me, it's really a portal for her to get from one state to the next state. And it's just from writing the book now as opposed to 10 years ago, not being so interested in having those strong rules of the fantastic world mapped out, and just wanting to get to South Carolina so I can start to continue the story. So,
a lot of my favorite genre books are like painful and almost like necessary reflections of reality, and like I wonder how maybe genre and like categorization has affected you or your process, and maybe if you have recommendations for books that maybe inspire you to like completely do away with that, because I love that in your books.
No, thanks. Yeah, I mean, I grew up reading science fiction and horror, and they inspired me to become a writer, and a lot of my friends, science fiction or comic books. Having a fantastic element doesn't seem weird or non-literary. When Zone 1 came out, which is the post-apocalyptic tale with zombies, I had to deal with this question a lot. And then I would just say, well, Beloved by Toni Morrison has a ghost. The Plot Against America, Philip Roth, alternative history. Never Let You Go, Ishiguro, Witches of Eastwick, Witches. You know, so it's not a big deal, but then people make a big deal out of it, even though so-called serious fiction writers use genre elements. For me, you know, I talk about seeing a connection between the fantastic and Garcia Marquez and Beckett. For me, Beckett doesn't take place on Earth. It's always like some weird abstract world, like Crap's last tape. For me, it takes place on some weird asteroid. Asteroid M from Marvel Comics, Magneto's Hideaway, floating through space, and there's a guy just reviewing his life in space. Waiting for Godot is like some kind of nuclear wasteland with like two trees and two dudes just trying to make sense. Or there's Borges or Garcia Marquez or whatever, they're using the fantastic as a tool. And I've written books that are realistic and books that have fantastic elements dialed up or dialed down. This book, rereading 100 Years of Solitude, was helpful. For many years, the different states in the book were more science fiction-y. So South Carolina took place in the future and there were genetic experiments in a sort of cloud atlas type of way. You're moving differently through time. And then I reread 100 Years of Solitude, and I was like, what if instead of having the fantasy cranked up to like a Spinal Tapian 11, I had it down on a level one? How would that do? And so 1850 became the time period, and people are reacting to the strange things that are going on in a sort of matter-of-fact way, that the way people do in a sort of traditional magic realism. That seemed to help. If you haven't read 100 Years of Solitude, I would say read that. Borges, he writes these sort of 30-page science fiction stories, which when I first read when I was 18, I was like, oh, this is like Twilight Zone. Really super compressed alternative realities. So Borges and Garcia Marquez, I'll recommend. So maybe one or two questions, maybe.
Hi, Colson. Thank you so much for coming. My question is, obviously the book is set in the past, but to me, when I read it, it was very much about the now, unfortunately. So what would you like us to learn about that? What can we do? Giving you free rein to add more to your comments before.
Yeah, I mean, when the book came out, people were asking me like, oh, you started writing it 2 years ago, were you inspired by Black Lives Matter? I was like, no, as a black man growing up in New York, I observe our periodic conversations about police brutality every 3 years. It's big, and then we sort of forget about it, and then we start up again, and that seems to be the cycle throughout my lifetime. So it wasn't a forefront in my mind. But then if you read stories from runaway slaves, and they describe slave patrollers, they're basically being stopped and frisked. And so, and the language they use, the humiliation of being stopped by a slave patroller, whether you're free or not, is the same language I use to describe being stopped by police. So whether you're free or not, the exact same process is happening, and the feelings it invokes are the same 150 years apart. So when the first book came out, I was like, no, this has nothing to do with Black Lives Matter, it's its own thing. Then after the election, I was like, I guess we are just talking about white supremacy still, and I think there's some of that in Ridgway and the slave catcher and his sort of justifications for his behavior. He's this idea about the American imperative, which is a mixture of manifest destiny, white supremacy, and then of course I was writing in a period where it seemed that we were in a different path, and then it seems like watching some of the rhetoric of the Trump rally or how the administration is conducting itself. Obviously, in some ways, we haven't come far at all, so I'll leave it there because I have Trump exhaustion. And this evening, I guess the Ninth Circuit Court struck down his Muslim ban, that's what we call it. So that was nice to see you before I came out. So one last question, if there's a microphone, okay.
This is a question about just your general look back on the writing process of the book. Do you feel like you fell short on anything, whether it has any flaws? The second part, going back to how you opened this this talk, it seems like your career has gone like supernova, and you know, this book that you've published has gone this like laundry list of awards. So, do you have any regrets?
Oh yeah, I regret a lot of the adjectives in The Intuitionist. John Henry Days could have been about 10 pages shorter. I might move some sections around in The Colossus of New York. I would do nothing to The Noble Hustle. I regret sitting through SWAT, the remake that came out 10 years ago. In terms of this book, people have asked, like, is there anything you want to put in that you didn't? There's nothing. And usually I have, like, things I cut and I put them in the file. I'm like, oh, maybe I'll recycle that one day. And then once the book is done, I never look at it again. With this, there's nothing I want to put in. There's nothing I want to take out. The final 20 pages are the best work I've done. And if I never wrote again, I'd be happy with the way the book ended up. So I have no regrets with this book. And definitely, you know, hopefully you get better may do something longer. So hopefully if I wrote Intuitionist now, it'd be a better book or different book. I can only write the best book I can when I'm 30 and the best book I can when I'm 32 and 36. And this is the best book I could write when I was 45. If I can just live up to that, try not to slack, try not to go too fast, try not to screw it up and just make it the best I can before I send it out, that seems like a good policy for me. So thanks for the question, and thanks so much for all you coming out.